Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How close are we to being finished in Iraq? Who's responsible for the state of the country today, more than 5 years after the U.S. invasion? And what is the most important thing U.S. forces must do to maintain the progress that has been made? My guest today can discuss those questions from the perspective of those with boots on the ground and the perspective of those in top leadership positions. Bing West served as Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration and as a Marine decorated for his time in combat in Vietnam. Today, he is a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. In the past 6 years, Bing West has taken 14 extended trips to Iraq, embedding with dozens of frontline units and discussing strategy with their commanders. His newest book, the third in a trilogy, is called The Strongest Tribe: War, Politics, and the Endgame in Iraq. Bing, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
You wrote this week that the war that you witnessed for 5 years in Iraq is now over. What has changed?
Well, there's no more violence or tiny amount of violence toward Americans. In July, there were 5 fatalities. Of course, we prefer that there be none, but that's the lowest number since the war began. The war for Americans being on the front lines is drawing to an end.
When many people hear those statements, they say they sound like an ideal justification for announcing a withdrawal date and pulling out. But you see that as a critical mistake.
I think that in 1953, after there was an armistice with North Korea, if we had abruptly pulled all our troops out, South Korea would have collapsed. The fact is that the Iraqis lack the self-confidence. They want the Americans there. Indeed, those who had been fighting us, the Sunni tribes in Anbar province to the west of Baghdad, Senator Obama visited them 2 weeks ago, and they presented him with a petition and asked him if he would please keep the United States Marines there with them because they were the most trusted force. So we've moved from a combat role to a role of trust.
And one of the things that remains to be done and strengthened in Iraq is the police force there. You write that it's one of the worst in the world. And at this point, the Iraqis aren't really capable of entirely running those police forces.
Every culture, of course, has its own cultural overhangs for how they do things. I don't think we'll ever straighten out the police the way we'd like police to be in the United States. They are lagging far behind the Iraqi army. The Iraqi army is the least sectarian of all the institutions in Iraq, and it is the Iraqi army that is the glue for the foreseeable future. The police are several years away from being anywhere near what we would consider police to be in the United States.
Does that mean that there will be an extended role for the U.S. in bolstering the Iraqi police force?
I believe so. In terms of mentors, what we're now doing, we actually have our soldiers and Marines living in police precincts. And that's working very well because the probity of our forces, the way they conduct themselves, is so important when you're trying to set an example that the Iraqi police and the Iraqi soldiers, but especially the police, can see how the Americans, who are by far the strongest tribe there, how the Americans behave. And they tend to copy what they see because they admire the skills that our soldiers have shown on the battlefield. But they bring an empathy to the people that gradually sinks in with the police.
And in fact, that's one of the changes that you think made a real difference, that initially U.S. soldiers and Marines were clustered on bases, as you say, commuting to work when they were working in these towns to provide security and a variety of different functions. Then they actually moved in and started having day-to-day contact with people.
That's correct. And you know, the fascinating thing here was that many of our generals, many of our top people said, look, that's an Arab culture. You cannot have Americans moving into the neighborhoods because they're an antibody. They will be rejected. Well, what that theory missed was that if you're in that neighborhood and people are extorting from you, people are robbing you on the street corner, people occasionally just drive by and shoot you, that if somebody walks in and says, that's it, I'm here, and that's not going to happen while I'm here, the first thing you do is you look at your own security, and then the second thing you do is you look at the fact that he's a foreigner, but if he's bringing security to you, that counts much more than the fact that he's an American and you're an Iraqi.
My guest is Bing West. He's former Assistant Secretary of Defense, now a correspondent for The Atlantic. His new book is called The Strongest Tribe, War, Politics, and the Endgame in Iraq. When did you first start observing that changes, that Iraq was really changing and that the conditions had improved based on what we were trying to do there?
In the fall of 2006, when everyone in Washington thought the war was being lost, I was in Ramadi, which was the toughest town, with a lieutenant colonel by the name of Bill Journey. And he was driving me. We were going around town, and he was saying to me, you know, I can change this. I'm going to get some of these Iraqi tribes to be working with me. You come back, and I'm going to show you that. And I thought, I had heard this for 3 years. I'll be darned if I didn't go back toward the end of 2006, and there were the Iraqis on the street corners with Journey's Americans. And that was toward the end of 2006 that you could see a change in attitude among the Sunni tribes beginning to show up before the surge.
And in fact, before the surge, as these relationships were being built, and in some cases, U.S. military personnel were sort of making deals with sheikhs on certain issues, this was something that the White House opposed, that the top leadership opposed, at least officially. But David Petraeus had a different idea of things.
It was pretty wild for a while there. I mean, you know, you could talk to a lot of these sheikhs or insurgents. They'll sit down at the table and talk with you forever. I mean, they'll talk forever. And a lot of them were in Jordan. And some of the Marine generals were flying to Jordan and talking with them. And this was upsetting a lot of people in Washington. They were basically saying, "Oh, what's our military doing talking to the other side?" But it was like you were talking one tribe to another and trying to make peace with them. And when General Petraeus came on board, he took one look at what was happening out in Anbar. He flew out to Ramadi. And he looked at some of these sheikhs sitting there talking with the Marines, and he said, "Holy smokes, okay, let's do that wherever you battalion commanders anywhere in the country think you can do it." And that's what opened up the floodgates.
Of course, Petraeus was responsible for the counterinsurgency field manual that the Army is now using. And when it first came out, people said this is a great document. Unfortunately, it's too late for this conflict. It won't have a difference in Iraq, but perhaps the next time we go into an aggressive action, this will make a difference. But you actually have seen that the counterinsurgency has worked faster here than it has in other wars.
And there was a terrifically brave, wonderful man by the name of Sheikh Sattar. He was killed by al-Qaeda, unfortunately, in 2007. But he actually organized the beginning of the tribes in 2006. His father had been killed by al-Qaeda. Three of his brothers had been killed by al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda became a poison in the bloodstream of the Sunnis, and they knew it. And Sattar stood up to them, and that made all the difference in how the war changed. It really wasn't so much the Americans that changed. Sattar said to me many times, he said, "We Sunnis had to make up our own mind."
And that's what you call the Sunni awakening.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And so at this point, the Sunnis are sort of organizing themselves in citizens' groups, and they are fighting against al-Qaeda. And how effective have they been?
Actually, they organize themselves as tribes, and the tribes know where their tribal areas are in ways that we don't. And what they began to do, they came to our American forces and they said, "If we point out the bad guys to you, will you arrest them or shoot them? Will you take them on?" And the Americans said, "Yes." And so what initially the tribes began to do was they would put on masks and they would be inside a Humvee and they'd be pointing out certain people on the streets to Americans. Then they realized this is working. They gathered more courage and in some of the mosques, they posted lists of names and said, "These names have 72 hours within which to sign a confession and say they will not work with al-Qaeda ever again." And then they moved out on their own, and Sheikh Ali Hatem, who's the crown prince out there, told me last week when I was in Iraq, he had an exact count of 477 people that the tribes had arrested, he didn't tell me what happened to them, but they on their own had arrested 477 people.
One of the people who's opposed these tribal groups is Prime Minister al-Maliki. He's worried that they're just militant Sunni groups in the making that are perhaps performing this function against al-Qaeda now but could turn at any minute. What would happen, do you think, Bing, if he were to try and disband them?
Wow. I mean, that is what keeps our generals awake at night. Prime Minister Maliki is a Shiite prime minister. He distrusts Sunnis. He marches to his own drummer. He is his own prime minister. If he did that, holy smokes, it would really upset things. And our people have told him time and time again, you cannot do that.
Is there any faith left among U.S. military commanders in the leadership skills of al-Maliki?
Could you rephrase it?
Well, does anyone think that he's up to the job that he needs to do to stabilize Iraq further?
I'm picking my words carefully. He is the prime minister of a sovereign country, and he is independent, and good luck to him. That's about as far as I can take that. He has shown an erraticism in his military decision making that is worrisome. On the other hand, he has broken the militia, and I think in private he would say, look, I'm a Shiite Arab. I understand my country better than you do, and sometimes it's a puzzle to us.
You're no longer on the federal dime. I'm wondering why you're choosing your words so carefully.
Because I do not know what goes through his mind. All I can do as an outside observer is watch events that do not follow a pattern that I, as an American, would really understand. I expected that when he moved against Muqtada Sadr's militia, that there would be much more fight in the militia than it turned out there was. And the militia now is splintered. So while he did what I considered to be a rash act in rushing down to the southern city of Basra and precipitating an offensive, actually turned out strategically to have been a good move. But I would not have predicted that ahead of time. So I pick my words carefully because I don't understand exactly what goes on inside the inner circle of Iraqi politicians.
Do you know how much contact, direct contact, al-Maliki has with the Defense Department and the White House about what he's planning to do?
Oh, I would say, you know, almost daily. The president personally calls him about once every 2 to 3 weeks on the televideo and talks with him to reassure him and buck him up as head of state to head of state. So he receives the highest degree of diplomatic and reach-out treatment.
My guest is Bing West. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic now. He's also former Assistant Secretary of Defense. He worked in the Reagan administration and a decorated combat veteran. His new book is called The Strongest Tribe, War, Politics, and the Endgame in Iraq. You can join us right after the break. Get on the line now at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Bing West. He is a correspondent for The Atlantic and a former Assistant Secretary of Defense. His new book is called The Strongest Tribe, War, Politics, and the Endgame in Iraq. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. You have written that the president failed in a couple of major ways in terms of executing the war, one of which is simply convincing the American people that this was something worth supporting.
Well, the first duty of the commander-in-chief with the bully pulpit is to unify the American people when you go to war, and the president failed to do that. And what disappointed me most was that he seems to take pride in being inarticulate, but you cannot continue to be inarticulate and believe that you're going to be leading a country when you're in war.
Given now that we seem to have invaded Iraq based on the assumption that there were weapons of mass destruction which didn't exist, does that dampen at all your sense that the president still should have been able to convince people to still be with him fully on the war effort?
No. The weapons of mass destruction not being there was a mistake in the judgment of intelligence communities around the world, not just in the United States, because Saddam deliberately wanted to mislead everyone because he wanted to keep Iran believing that he had weapons of mass destruction. Saddam could have avoided that by simply saying, look, I don't have them, and inspectors are welcome in. So I don't see that as basically being President Bush's mistake or a reason not to support a war. I mean, my basic philosophy is once the United States, the Congress, and you go to the United Nations and the Congress votes to use force, then you're in the war, then prevail in the war. And then if you don't like your politicians, turn them out of office, vote them out. But don't quit in the middle of a war. I think that's the wrong thing to do for the nation.
You've been disappointed with the media as well, and you make the comparison between this war and World War II, where mistakes and problems and missteps were really minimized in the media, and heroism and the valiant acts of our soldiers were magnified. Is it fair to make that comparison?
I think it's very fair because our press have no one who holds them accountable except the American people as a whole, and they are the fourth estate. They're the fourth branch of government. And therefore, there are some obligations upon the press. And when I looked at what happened at Haditha, which was a terrible, terrible tragedy, but it was not a cold-blooded massacre, and there were court martials, etc. But the press devoted 20 or 30 times as much coverage to allegations that turned out to be false as they did to any act of bravery during the war. And if a country cheapens courage, if it gets to the point where it says, well, we just assume courage, then that country is in trouble in a tough war. And I think that we have to draw back a little bit and ask, did we have the right balance? And I don't think we did have the right balance.
How do you strike that balance in your own writing for The Atlantic?
Well, what I try to do more than anything else is to focus on what's actually happening on the ground. I'm a Tolstoy believer. When Tolstoy wrote War and Peace, he was trying to describe history, and he said, some people believe that history is driven by great men. And you can think in terms of Napoleon was what he was referring to, but it could be Lincoln, et cetera, Washington, whomever. And that the people follow the great leader, and that's a popular way of looking at things. But Tolstoy said, if you really look carefully, that what happens with history is it's driven by the mood of the people, and a good leader senses that mood and goes with the people as a whole. And definitely an insurgency starts from the bottom up. So in my writing for The Atlantic and every other place, I've tried to go out to the cities and go down to the platoon level and stay with them and write it from the bottom up. And then I'll go back and I'll ask the generals, what are they doing? But I don't start with the generals. I start with the lieutenants and the sergeants on the ground, and then I try to show what they're doing versus what people are saying is happening.
Now that the insurgency is no longer such a threat, there is still a great deal of terrorist activity taking place in Iraq. Is this somehow any easier to manage than the insurgency?
Oh, I think much so, because the terrorists and Al-Qaeda is gradually really hurting itself throughout the Middle East, because every time it sends out these suicide murderers and just blasts crowds of people and kills them, that reverberates around the Middle East, as did the Sunni tribes rebelling against them. And I think it's greatly weakening Al-Qaeda. But the way you hunt down terrorists are with specialists, our special forces, that are 10% of our forces in Iraq are special forces, and they account for about 70% of the terrorists that are tracked down. So as it moves more toward a terrorist kind of war, you do not need anywhere near as many troops on the ground.
Do you think Al-Qaeda is weakening even in places like Pakistan?
Pakistan is, I have not been to Pakistan recently, and therefore I don't think I am qualified to speak relative to Pakistan. Clearly the large problem in Pakistan is the frontier region, which is the size from New York City to Florida, where no one is in charge except the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And that's become a huge, huge sanctuary. Now, the question, how much do the tribes accept Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and how much is it imposed on them? As an outsider, I cannot answer that question.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Bing West. His new book is called The Strongest Tribe. Let's go to Tim in Arlington. Hello, Tim.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
Yes, Mr. West, I'd like to ask, how deep do you think the divide is between the Sunnis and the Shias? Just today, the bombing of the Shia pilgrims indicates it's still very deep. And one can argue that the Sons of Iraq, the Sunnis, were simply formed so they could get arms from the U.S. And we are simply arming them and making, ultimately, the situation worse.
The division between the Sunnis and the Shiites was not so passionate that they continued what began as a spiral into a civil war in 2006. You see them sitting in the same National Assembly. You see them going to the same meetings and grumbling at each other. You see that they're well on their way to they're already there. They are insisting on these provincial elections because the Sunni tribes believe they're going to pick up an enormous number of seats. So they're very quarrelsome. They're very distrustful of one another. It will take decades for that to overcome, but it has moved off the battlefield and more into the political arena. And I think that's a healthy switch, but it doesn't mean that they trust each other one bit, but it does mean that they're trying to work out their differences in about as fractious a manner as our own Congress does.
We have an email that refers to the Concerned Local Citizens Program, which is what has come out of the Sunni Awakening that you described earlier. The writer says, the program simply pays insurgents to become temporary allies of the U.S. military. Approximately 70,000 former enemy combatants are now paid to play nice, and it all costs us $700,000 a day. Do you agree with that characterization?
The writer is correct almost to the penny in terms of the cost. It's about $300 million a year that the United States is paying. I don't agree that they're just playing nice. I mean, I was just there last week and met with some of them that I've known for a year, and they very proudly showed me their soccer fields and their marketplaces, et cetera. It's more equivalent to these Sunnis belong to certain neighborhoods where the Shiite death squads have been attacking them 2 years ago. Now they have their own neighborhoods back. The Americans are right there with them, and the Iraqi soldiers are right there with them. And no, they've turned away from violence. It's beyond violence now. It's into who's getting the stalls in the marketplace, who's getting the microloans. I didn't even wear body armor on this last trip. It's really changed a corner. So you get into arguments such as, well, who can queue up for a loan of $2,000 rather than who has an AK-47? So it's much more stable when you're there than it seems from the outside. Do they like each other? No, they don't like each other, but they're not shooting at one another.
And you don't think there's any danger being that those payments function as ultimately like protection money. And the moment that funding dries up, that the people who have been members of the concerned local citizens groups no longer have any interest in sort of playing nice or doing the right thing.
Yes, I have great concern about that.
Mm-hmm.
Great concern about that. This is an area where I think constant pressure is being applied. There has to be a way of transitioning these concerned local citizen groups, of which there must be, I'll just take a guess, there must be 500 to 1,000 of them. You have to bring some of them into the police, some of them into the Army, and you have to supply others with jobs. But given that the entire program is $300 million, in a country that now has a $70 billion budget, the issue is not the cost of the program. The issue is whether Prime Minister Maliki, in his heart, is willing to reach out and reach a reasonable compromise with those who were his enemies.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Bing West is my guest. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic Now and a former Assistant Secretary of Defense. His book is called The Strongest Tribe, War, Politics, and the Endgame in Iraq. Let's speak next to Jonathan in Fort Worth. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. Mr. West, I'm going to call on your deep well of knowledge and your extreme expertise here. In a synopsis, could you explain to me, I'm pretty ignorant, but I've heard this term tribe thrown around, the sheikh of this tribe, the sheikh of that tribe, and you just used the term the crown prince. That's the first time I've heard that used. Could you just give me a brief overview so I can better understand, are these tribes that were there as desert wanderers that became Muslims, do they go that far back, or is this more recent? What is the history of this tribes in short?
There are the Sunnis have stronger tribes than the Shiites, but if the Shiites were listening to me, they'd be saying that's not true. But both of them have very strong tribes, and together they probably have 45 major tribes, of which about four or five really have primacy. And the one sheikh I was mentioning, Ali Hatem, he comes from the Jabouri tribe, which is one of the two most dominant tribes in Anbar to the west. The tribes would say that they are the true Muslims who first converted back in the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries. And they would say that the land is theirs long before there were central governments. And to a large extent, their argument now is that they were shoved out of power unnecessarily. When the Americans came in with this concept of democracy and allowed certain lists, just plain lists, to be put up for election when people didn't even know who they were voting for. And so the Shiite tribes are as angry as the Sunni tribes, saying, hey, we were cut out of this whole thing you called a democracy, and if you took a revote, you would see that we will get, they would claim a majority of the seats. So they believe that their lines of pedigree and their knowledge and the fact that their sheikhs are respected is such that in the next election, which should have happened this year and it better happen by the beginning of next year, that they will pick up a very large number of seats, and they're betting an awful lot heavily on that.
Is that summary, which obviously reflects just a tiny overview of what you know, is that something that Paul Bremer could have given at a moment's notice?
Mr. Bremer went a different way. There were two proposals that I know of that went to him very early on that said, we have a real problem with the Sunni tribes believing that they have been disenfranchised. And we believe, this came from the Foreign Service officer, Keith Mines, who was the senior Foreign Service officer in Anbar, and from the general out there, Swanick. And they said, we recommend, instead of going the way you're going, that you allow a lawyer jirga the way we had in Afghanistan, where you bring all the tribes together for one huge tribal meeting and let them apportion some power among themselves. They bring together 200 or 300 people. They'll figure it out. And then from there, eventually, we can go to elections. Mr. Bremer chose not to go that way, and the Sunnis believe that they had been disenfranchised.
A lot of people think that the biggest mistake that Paul Bremer made in his part in all this was disbanding the Iraqi army. What do you think about that?
General Conway, who's the commandant of the Marine Corps, and General Mattis, who's in charge of all our forces for the Joint Forces Command, believe that very strongly. They believe that although the army had dissolved when we were marching to Baghdad, they were willing to get back in their ranks very, very quickly, and that we had the linkages to do that. And I saw that firsthand in 2003 down in Diwanir when 10,000 former soldiers lined up to get a payment. And the lieutenant colonel there turned to General Mattis and said, "We can have our pick. We can make our own battalions, anything you want. Look at them all." So I do believe that it was the major mistake, not from the start, bringing back the Iraqi army. We could have changed a lot of the leaders, but the Iraqi army wanted to stay. It did not want to be disbanded.
You've characterized General Sanchez as having been in denial about a lot of the problems that were going on. Can you talk about the things that he really didn't notice or address in due time?
General Sanchez was the Lieutenant General Sanchez was the first commander we had over there. And unfortunately, Lieutenant General Sanchez had just been promoted to Lieutenant General, and he was thrown into a situation that was chaotic. But he never published an order for his division commanders and said, "Look, guys, this is what we're going to do systematically." And instead, each division did what the American Army and American Marine Corps will do. It went charging off looking for the enemy. But that's the wrong way to go. When you're in an insurgency, you have to start by bringing security to the population, not by pulling raids that antagonizes the population. So we went the wrong way at the beginning of this war.
My guest is Bing West. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic and former Assistant Secretary of Defense. His new book is called The Strongest Tribe, War, Politics, and the Endgame in Iraq. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. After the break, we will talk more about what can happen next in Iraq.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour to Bing West. His new book is called The Strongest Tribe, War, Politics, and the Endgame in Iraq. If you want to join us, send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. You've talked about the new realities of modern warfare and the fact that you think at this point the U.S. military is adjusting to those realities much faster than the American public. Can you talk about that?
Well, there are two aspects with the American public that we have to understand going forward. And what's the new reality of warfare is that our enemies have learned not to wear uniforms and to hide and to fight us among the population. When you think back to all prior wars, even Vietnam, we were fighting organized forces in uniform that stayed away from the population. Population, both sides felt was out of bounds and really interfered with the battle. Now we're fighting people who pose as civilians. This means that the U.S. military, in large extent, becomes a police force, and it has to find a way of identifying one civilian versus one insurgent. And our military is just learning how to do this a little bit at a time because it's a brand new way of looking at warfare. On the other hand, our society, if you look at the Supreme Court, for instance, decision by one vote to allow those who fight us who are not in uniform to petition throughout our court system as though they were American citizens with habeas corpus, puts our soldiers on this battlefield and future battlefields in a heck of a position. Our soldiers are becoming arresting officers that two of them have to swear out an affidavit. Many times you have to get a warrant before you arrest somebody. Then you have to bag the evidence. You have to take digital pictures. You have to sign sworn statements identical to what you do if and read people their Miranda rights, and you're on a battlefield. And then the odds of them being released become higher and higher because many times you don't have any proof. I've been in a lot of battles where you'd be taking fire from a row of houses or something, and when you close on the houses, some males are walking down the street, but they have no weapons, and then you go inside and you find some weapons. Well, which one had the weapon? So when you begin to accord to everybody the rights and privileges of the United States judicial system, you can strangle the entire system if we take this too far. For instance, right now in Iraq, we are holding 20,000 Iraqis, and in Afghanistan, we're holding a few thousand Afghanis. Now, if they all petitioned and received the same treatment in Guantanamo, our courts would be completely clogged. So I think we have a ways to go in straightening out how we deal with people who are fighting us and they don't have uniforms on.
Well, when you're bringing 20,000 people into custody as what I suppose could be called prisoners of war, obviously you're going to make some mistakes. Do we need to just find a way as a population to not find it intolerable that there may be a great many entirely innocent people who never put on a uniform, who have nothing to do with insurgent activity, that are held against their will?
This is a problem. And you get to the question of how do you resolve that? They put in safeguards, but you can always make that argument. Indeed, everyone who goes to prison in Iraq, as in the United States, protests that he is innocent. No one is ever guilty in his own mind. But if you're fighting a war, you have to work out a system that is somewhat equitable, but doesn't end up getting your own forces killed because you're fighting the same person time and again.
They call it catch and release over there, don't they?
Unfortunately, they do.
Meaning that they catch someone, they have to let them go, and then there are questions as well about the recidivism rate of people who are captured and then released because there's not effective evidence. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The recidivism rate, that's the wrong way to put it, I think, when I think of it. The rearrest rate. Recidivism means you committed a crime once, then you did it a second time. Rearrest means that you arrested one person, then arrested him again. The rearrest rate hovers between 1% and 7% or 8%, which is the lowest, one of the lowest rates, if not the lowest rate in the world, which would cause you to say, wait a minute, what's going on here? Does something magically happen when they go to jail one time so that they never repeat, when repeat offenders in the United States are 67% of violent crimes? Or do we have a system here where we're not picking them up again, and there may be a lot of tribal justice going on out there and other intervening variables that we do not understand? And that's the situation we're in. On the face of it, the recidivism slash rearrest rate is a world's record low. But on the other hand, so many thousands of innocent Iraqis were killed, were murdered, that you have to wonder, what happened to all those killers?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Walter in Dallas. Hi, Walter.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Great, thank you.
Just a couple of comments for your guest. The first, early on in the program, he compared the situation in Korea with Iraq. I really don't think that they're comparable. I think we got an apple and an orange. In Korea, you had a well-armed and well-trained and effective army right there on the river. There had to be some military presence there, obviously. I don't think you have the same situation in Iraq. Secondly, in discussing how we got in the war in the first place and why President Bush was unable to convince the public, That country was inspected very well by the Atomic Commission of the United Nations. the chairman of which said there aren't any there. It's well known, and people close to the situation, people that were involved, the books who come out have been numerous about the pressure that was put on by Cheney and others in the White House on the CIA to provide the kind of so-called intelligence that they felt they needed to go to war. And I think also of the group, the Project for the New American Century, which had an existing policy urging then-President Clinton to declare war on Iraq. And, of course, the signers of that letter were high members of the Bush administration, led, again, by Cheney and Rumsfeld. I think anybody who studied things could see that the reasons for going to war were bogus. At one point, when both of
them... Walter, you made some great points.
The other was the...
I think we've...
Walter,
I think we've got your points.
I'm saying it has something to do with 9/11, which was...
Right. I got it. Thank you very much for your call, Walter. I need to move on so that we can make sure that Bing has time to answer, because you brought up some interesting points. Do you want to start with the comparison between Korea and Iraq?
Sure. The comparison with Korea and Iraq, Walter's quite right, which brings in another variable that we hadn't discussed, namely Iran. Unfortunately, the Shiite militia that retreated after the battles in Basra and Baghdad, many of them are now in terrorist camps in Iran, and some of our forces and some Iraqi forces have now deployed along the border because we are expecting that they'll be trained as terrorists and sent back into Iraq. So the variable of Iran, unfortunately, has arisen in Iraq in a malign way. But basically, you just can't pull everybody out at once. I mean, common sense basically says, look, if we did that, we'd be recognized as quitting and the morale of the Iraqis would just plummet. Doesn't mean we have to stay there and the numbers we're in at all. It just means we have to be judicious about how we withdraw. Concerning the weapons of mass destruction and Vice President Cheney, et cetera, I guess we could argue about 2003 forever, and I'm not trying to make the case for them one way or the other. My issues had to do with once a war starts, what do you do? Not how it started. So I'm on a different wavelength, and I really cannot enter into those debates because it's not what I studied. I studied how the war was fought and how it was turned around in 2006. Not the mistakes that were made at the beginning.
With the disclaimer that, in fact, Senator John McCain has a blurb of praise on the jacket of your book, I wonder if you can talk about what the next president will need to do and what position they appear to be in to take the appropriate action.
I would be very surprised if we do not. I mean, Senator McCain basically has said, let's stay. And in essence, I think he's going to get into the position of saying, let's withdraw gradually most of our troops and keep some there. And I'd be very surprised if that isn't just about where Senator Obama ends up. Now, I know Senator Obama has been saying, no, I'm going to withdraw all our combat troops. But every single American general at the top has been saying, Senator, in all due deference, that's really not what you're going to do. And I think we're going to see a convergence on this subject, in fact, if not in rhetoric, and that is, I'd be very, very surprised to see if the next president of the United States just abruptly pulled the plug, regardless of which one is president.
We have now spent something above $20 billion on reconstruction efforts in Iraq. Is the money being wisely applied?
In my judgment, no, and we should not have done it. And I would be very cautious about going forward in Afghanistan with a similar project. I believe that there are certain limits that the United States should be aware of and not try to rebuild nations. We can rebuild their military if we focus on that and then let them get on with their own social structures. When we undertake enormous projects in other countries, we're not Iraqis, we're not Afghanis, and I do not believe that we spent our money wisely in doing this in Iraq, and I would be I'd be hesitant to endorse us trying that in Afghanistan or some other place.
So is it a matter of deciding ahead of time when we're going to let go and what things we're going to leave to them, whether we think that will turn out well or not?
I believe so. I believe that's exactly what you have to do in your planning. You must look ahead of time. And I could say, I'm going to go into a place like Iraq and Afghanistan, and I know that our battalions are going to be on the ground in different cities and villages, and they are going to be looked up to by the people, and people expect that America can do things nobody else can. And therefore, I'm going to give every battalion commander an allowance, if you will, walking around money, called WASTA, you know, to get influence. But that's the extent of it. I'm not going to try to redo the electric or the sewers or the school system of the entire country. I'll be judicious in it, and I will work from the bottom up, and I believe you can do that. But that's quite different than trying to rebuild an entire nation.
You've said that too many Americans misunderstand the fact that when there is war, there will be casualties, even modern war, even war with a lot of technology. Do you think we would have hesitated more before entering this war if more Americans had really thought hard about that possibility?
No, I do not. I think it's the opposite. I think it's the other dimension that makes the difference. It's the length of the war without seeing that you're succeeding that I think gets to the American people. The American people will say, all right, I'm willing to pay a certain cost, and I understand that these are volunteers in the Army and the Marine Corps, and that they're tough guys, and they're willing to take a risk. But I want to have some assurances that we can prevail and that we can do so in a reasonable time frame. And so I think as the war just dragged out and as we were losing through 2006, people lost spirit. And that's why in my book I try to focus on how did the war turn around after 2006, and because there were some lessons to be learned there before we charge off into Afghanistan.
You have a son on active duty right now, is that right?
No, he's back off active duty now, but he's done two tours in the Marine Corps, and then he goes back to his civilian job, and then he goes back again, and then he comes back again.
Were you able to pick up some interesting insight talking to him about his experiences?
Well, ironically, you know, I bumped into him several times. I mean, that just shows you how small the Marine Corps really is. And he was the advisor to, the last time, he was the senior advisor to an Iraqi battalion between Ramadi and Fallujah. So I learned an awful lot. And then his interpreter came back to the United States and stayed with us for the summer while he became an American citizen and then joined the Marines. So I learned an awful lot talking to them about what was going on the ground at the point of the spear.
Well, I hope they will both stay safe if they
go
back.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bing West served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. He's a Marine combat veteran and today writes for The Atlantic. His newest book is called The Strongest Tribe, War, Politics, and the Endgame in Iraq. Bing, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.